We go beyond the journal articles and into the laboratory and the field as scientists share their discoveries in a way everyone can understand. It's Science Explained. You're listening to Science Sound Off on Texas A&M Health Talk. Welcome to Science Sound Off. I'm Christina Sumners.
And I'm her co-host, Tim Schnettler.
And with us today, we have Dr. David Reiner. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
So you're from the Texas A&M Institute of Biosciences and Technology.
Yes, right? In Houston. A lot of people don't know that we have a pretty sizable footprint in Houston. And we have a research institute there with scientists who are located full-time in Houston.
So tell us a little bit more, before we get started on your research, tell us a little bit more about what IBT does and what kind of things go on at IBT.
So we're actually on the small side. You'd think that we have a research tower, but we're about the size of a department here in Bryan College Station. And unlike a department, we're not that thematically organized. So we're actually quite diverse. We have cardiac biologists. You have very basic scientists like me. You have clinical people, drug discovery people, cancer biologists. And the reason we do that is we're located in the world's largest medical center. And so when you're a self-contained college town, your nearby expertise is what's right there. For us, within a 5-minute shuttle or 15-minute walk are some several world-class institutions. We have Rice, Baylor College of Medicine, UT Health, and MD Anderson, the world's largest cancer center. And I think 22 hospitals in the medical center. It's the world's largest medical center. It's actually pretty astonishing how many people are there. And so that's a large part of why we're there. We're a portal or a confluence of information between College Station and Houston.
So you work closely with some of the hospitals and other institutions in the area?
Well, there are people in our building who are more translational, which is the word we use, but from experiments in the lab to patients. And so they interact with clinicians more frequently. I'm what's called a basic scientist, just looking at fundamental principles of life. And so I interact with similar counterparts at other institutions. Some of my colleagues on my floor, my neighbor, actually interact at the clinical end pretty regularly.
So let's talk about some of those fundamentals of life.
Yeah, let's do that. let's see.
You're a geneticist.
I am a geneticist by training. Okay. And I think now I call myself a developmental geneticist. I've worn different hats in the past, including neuroscience. And what developmental genetics means is that we use mutations in animals to study how they develop, how they're put together. And these are some of the fundamental rules of life, the operating system, if you will. And so we actually do this in a very specific organism, and it's not a cute fuzzy organism. It's actually a very, very tiny worm. And I always tell people, if you want to know how big this is, hold your fingers a millimeter apart, and now you know how big a worm is. this is Caenorhabditis elegans, and it's one of the major invertebrate model organisms, along with an organism people may be more familiar with, the fruit fly that you find on your bananas. That's another, Drosophila melanogaster, is a very common research organism. So my lab works almost entirely on this, although we do collaborate with humans to take our findings into, people that work with cells in a dish will find something in a worm, will actually take it into human cells in a dish that a cancer researcher, say, is working on. And we've had a couple papers where our discoveries are translated like that.
Why worms?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to do that, I'm actually going to digress into fruit flies. Okay. And they were actually readily available, like I said, on your bananas as they got older. And so in the early 1900s, fruit flies were harnessed to discover some of the most fundamental aspects of genetics. What is a chromosome? What is a gene? And worms, actually, as a research organism, C. elegans was started in the 60s because they knew where the shortcomings of the Drosophila system was. And this, we're sort of rival siblings, and the C. elegans is the younger sibling, so I was taking pot shots at the older one. and so in the 60s, a visionary scientist in Britain, Sidney Brenner, actually secured funding to say, we can study in the simplest possible organism that you can have and still have all the issues of being multicellular, let's figure out key pieces of developmental biology, of neuroscience, strip it down as simple as it can be, and we'll learn a lot. And he won a Nobel Prize. So he turned out to be a visionary scientist. And he founded a field that actually now I think encompasses 3,000 or 4,000 people worldwide, and not quite as big as the Drosophila community, and really, but they are now of equal stature, and we learn a lot about biology. So to illustrate some points that C. elegans brings to the table is it's really fast. We get two generations per week.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay.
They're also really small and easy to culture. So they're a millimeter in size, like I said. They have 959 normal cells and then about 1,000 reproductive cells. And every single cell is in the same place in every animal. And this is actually the only experimental animal where this is the case. So if you're looking at a neuron, say, or some developing skin cell, we know its ancestry all the way back to the single cell that started the animal. And that's actually a tremendous advantage for experimentalists. We can shoot DNA into them to make transgenics pretty easily, so experiments are great. We can do mutant screens where we just randomly pick up interesting biological defects. So that's why we do it. We learn a lot about human biology, and the thing that's amazing is actually that an astonishing number of genes that you find in a human that are clinically important you can find in a worm or a fruit fly.
So what sort of genetic manipulations are you doing? Are you using traditional gene editing, CRISPR? What?
Yeah, so the old school method is you dump a chemical mutagen on the animals and you look for random effects in the process you're interested in. The new school method, actually the maybe less old method, is to shoot in DNA that will be inherited and make what we call a transgenic. Mm-hmm. You can do this in other systems, you know, more complex systems will take you months or even years. In a worm, we can do it in a week or two. And but now, of course, we're doing CRISPR. And you know, I was an enthusiastic passenger on the bandwagon right from day one of CRISPR and C. elegans. I was fortunate enough to collaborate with people that did the first CRISPR knock-ins in C. elegans. And so we published that in 2013. And we went in whole hog. I mean, we are into CRISPR. It's enormously powerful tool for us, and you know, everybody hears about it in the news. It's a big deal, and it makes our research much more powerful and quick. We can do stuff we never dreamed of doing before.
Could you explain just what CRISPR is for people who may not know?
Yeah, so CRISPR is a molecular scissors, and the genome, the entire DNA complement in every cell you have, the chromosomes, is huge. Humans have 3 billion letters in their code. Worms have 100 million, so it's 30 times smaller. Same number of genes. That's always surprises people. People think that because we're humans, we must have many more genes. I said we have a lot more cells, but not necessarily that many more genes. Mm-hmm. And what CRISPR does is it's the things that makes it different than everything that came before. It's remarkably precise. So you can cut one spot in the genome. You just cut the chromosome. And then the other thing is it's efficient. So the scale is you can look through, you know, 100 or 200 animals or something and find this change, whereas old technologies were very expensive and you'd have to screen through tens of thousands. So very difficult. Who cares? Why would you want to break a chromosome? So we can actually break genes to look at their function. We can also insert things into genes. One thing we call tagging. So we put a piece of fluorescent protein and then a little barcode on these, and we can actually track now the gene. It will make a protein, and we can see where the protein goes in the cell. And we're doing this, you know, during development. We'll see cells, proteins that we're studying actually suck up against the surface of the cell. And we've never seen this kind of stuff before in biology. And the reason is when we do it with the old transgenic method, we just flood them with tons of protein and we swamp out that delicate little signal. So, of course, you also need advanced microscopy to see this. But so CRISPR is changing how we do stuff. Now, I know everybody's thinking about what was in the news recently with editing a baby in China. Twins, actually, I think it was. And so that's very controversial. I don't endorse that, just so we're clear. but as an experimental, and, you know, eventually CRISPR can probably be used as a therapeutic.
For severe genetic diseases.
Yeah, and we could talk about that. I actually go to CRISPR workshops occasionally. But for us, it's a fantastic experimental tool.
Just because you can be so precise with...
Yeah, you can change just one letter in that whole code. And so you can really do designer genetics, whereas before I felt we were bashing with a sledgehammer. Now we have a scalpel. And that's what I always tell people, the difference between a sledgehammer and a scalpel. And it's really fantastic. And it's me and 10,000 of my closest friends doing this. So it's not like, you know, I invented CRISPR and I, but it is something that everybody is just so enthusiastic about.
Well, and one of the things that y'all have used that for deals with cancer treatment, chemotherapy, mm-hmm. and drug resistance by cells. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So I said I'm a developmental geneticist. What we study, and everybody kind of glazed over when I said this, is signaling networks in a cell. And they said, oh, what's that? And my response is, think of it like a spider web. There's a really, or an internet, hub and a bunch of connections, or, you know, cell phone towers, whatever, something that's decentralized and communicating information. The signals that bounce around a cell and between cells are similar. So one of the things we're learning is that if in cancer, if you have, you know, a really strong driver of cancer, this thing is driving the tumor, there are actually fantastic drugs there in the clinic. They'll target that. The tumor will regress astonishingly. And, you know, I actually use a picture of humans with metastatic melanoma, so it's spread all over the body. It's a really striking picture because the person's covered with lumps. You treat them with a small molecule inhibitor, and it's a really specific and good one. The lumps go away in, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, and then a couple months later they come back. And that's really the problem, because if you imagine a spider web, you can snip one strand, but the web's still there.
Right.
And so what tumors do is they're enormously flexible, and so they can find a rewiring. And probably what happens is that in the billions of cells in a tumor, some of those are going to already have been mutated by chance. And they're not doing so hot within the context of the tumor, but then you hit them with a drug that hits 99.99% of their neighbors, and now they're the only one that survives. They grow back out, now you have a new tumor right where the old one was. And so thinking about them as a network and understanding how networks work, how is the spider web put together? And so we can see what happens and actually understand how this affects development. And almost everything in disease is something, a natural healthy process that's been, you know, messed up.
Right.
It's been perverted. It's been, you know, it's been broken, whatever, however you want to put that. And so understanding how they normally work is a big part of understanding how they work in disease.
That makes sense.
Does it? Great.
So the goal is to make these tumors more susceptible to the chemotherapy drugs?
Yeah, so that is a great question. And so the idea there is actually, the analogy I use for people is to think back to HIV and AIDS. Most people know now that HIV infection is not a death sentence. It's actually treatable, and people have good, long, high-quality lives, right? And the trick was, and HIV actually, just as a little digression, HIV is also what we call hypermutable. It changes. And so even one person can now develop multiple HIV populations in their body. Same deal. Treat them with one drug, it regresses, they're happy, they're healthy, and then it will come back. Mm-hmm. The trick there was to identify a triple drug cocktail that hit three different parts of the virus. And when you're hitting three things, it can't actually bypass all simultaneously. And so that combination, as long as the patient takes the drugs regularly, right, as long as they don't miss a dose or mess around, that triple drug cocktail has been fantastic. And this actually happened in the 90s. We've known for a long time that this is possible with cancer. The old school treatments are actually to poison somebody, essentially, but the tumor is more sensitive, so you feel sick, but the tumor dies. There are problems with that, the obvious one being that you feel really sick. The designer drugs that specifically target one part of the tumor, and that's the one I described with the metastatic melanoma, is they're very, very, very specific, and it's not poisoning. You're actually blocking one thing in the cell. But the multi-drug cocktail is probably going to be the ticket here. And even not even just drugs. I mean, this year's Nobel Prize was immunotherapies, and treating cancer by harnessing your own immune system. So there are multiple prongs of an attack on this kind of thing, and that's because cancer is 200 different diseases, minimum, and they can change really quickly. And so that's why you need multi-prong attacks. And everybody always says, why haven't you guys cured cancer yet? It's a great question. The problem is it's like 200 diseases that are constantly changing. So some of them, for technical reasons, we can get at pretty quickly. Others you can't. And so if we understand the networks, then the smart chemists and medical oncologists and folks like that can actually figure out how to put together multi-drug cocktails. And some of those strands in the spider web we don't even know exist yet. And that's what my lab does. We try to understand what those strands are. And if we can identify those and figure out how they relate to the other strands, cancer biologists can take that information and maybe develop those triple drug cocktails.
Can take it from there and actually come up with a drug to treat patients.
That's the goal. The other thing I would talk about is actually the law of unintended consequences. So, I was actually had dinner Tuesday night with some folks over at Baylor College of Medicine. We'd had a speaker. I had sort of related work, so they invited me. We're very collegial in the TMC, so I know people at all these other institutions. And there was a Drosophila person at the table, and to go back to that joke, we were quite civil for siblings. But he was saying, he was reciting some facts that I'd heard before, is that if you look at the total NIH budget for research, about 3% is for just fruit fly research, and about 2% is for C. elegans research. We're cheap as well as fast. And he pointed out that if you looked at Nobel Prizes as a rough measure for mind-blowing breakthroughs, that if you looked at simple organisms where research was done, and that would be bacteria, yeast. People are always surprised that they like beer or bread, but that yeast is actually a great experimental organism for a single cell. How does a single cell work? One of my professors in grad school got a Nobel Prize for work on this kind of stuff. And then worms and fruit flies. That actually accounts for about half of all Nobel Prizes. So in terms of return on investment, that's a great return. Now, if you add mice into that, now you're close to 100%. And mice, of course, are the gateway, the closest thing to a human. If you look at all that, that actually spells out the justification for these model organisms, whether they're a vertebrate like a mouse or the invertebrates or even the single-celled yeast. This is why we do it. Because history has told us that the things that change the world are unexpected and come from just digging around and doing good science. And you don't even have to say, I'm going to cure this disease. You have to say, I'm going to do good science and figure out what these things do. And surprisingly, we're terrible at predicting them. And it's almost because it's so mind-blowing, we can't possibly imagine it. If we could, we would just do it. So they come out of, left field. And CRISPR is the best example. It actually started from people working on really obscure bacteria, and not even pathogenic bacteria, just stuff that grows out in the world. And they found that these bacteria have an immune system. And the enzyme that governs that is called Cas9. So people sometimes refer to CRISPR-Cas or CRISPR-Cas9. And so, they said, wow, this thing's really target, it cuts things with enormous specificity. This was done, that breakthrough was done at Berkeley in California. And then somebody at MIT said, oh yeah, we can put that in a cell and cut specific things. And those people are probably going to win a Nobel Prize. So that sometimes they're betting pools. And I don't want to overemphasize the importance of a Nobel Prize, because there are tens of thousands of scientists who do great work and never get, tuxedos and meet the King of Sweden. But this is why we do science, right? And the law of unintended consequences is actually one of the most profound things if you know about science. The shortest distance between two points is not necessarily a straight line, right? And often in science, it looks like somebody just working out in left field, they're doing something far more important than you are. We just don't know yet. And that's why science seems so broad. And people say, why is somebody working a worm? Well, there are a few Nobel Prizes, and then a lot of Lasker Prizes, and a bunch of other prizes, and top papers in top journals that tell you why. And connections like we try to translate to cancer biologists. And so this is why we do this kind of stuff. The other thing is, it's so simple that we can do research in a way that's really elegant, and our findings can be really concrete, because with a quick life cycle, we can test them every which way. So there's really not any ambiguity.
And the genetics of these organisms so well that...
So the C. elegans was the first multicellular organism to have its genome sequenced. This was so important that when I was in grad school, I actually switched projects.
Really?
Yeah. The gene I was interested in was in a wasteland, and I'd been trying to find it like a needle in a haystack for about a year. And then the sequence project mowed through chromosome 3, where there was another gene I was interested in, and I found it in a month. And so, and then soon after that, the whole genome was sequenced. But technology frequently drives, you have to be aware of it and be prepared to change your approach. You have to stay nimble and flexible. True for all of science, not just me.
So what were you working on in grad school to begin with, and then what did you switch
behavior,
to?
Behavior, actually. Okay. So C. elegans actually... All right, so the C. elegans nervous system is largely dispensable for viability, so they can actually reproduce without most of the nervous system there because they self-fertilize. And this was actually why Sidney Brenner selected them in the first place. Self-fertilizing, check. That'll make studying nervous system function a lot easier. They don't need to mate. A fly, you know... They actually have a male and a female, and they have to get together, and that requires locomotion. And
then their genes get mixed up.
Right. So a worm, they just sit there, and they reproduce. And so it's actually, but we actually did a variety of behaviors. It was a lot of fun. You know, we had to develop, we were actually making up as we go along, developing new assays. Well, how do we measure behavior? How do we look at this? What do we track? And so there are a variety of behaviors, and like everything else, C. elegans is fairly simple. They move, they eat, they poop, they lay eggs. That's about it. But the truth is there were some really remarkable behaviors that they do. They can do associative learning, right? So if you feed them and put some neutral chemical in there, butenone is I know that's just a random collection of syllables, but butenone is an organic chemical that doesn't hurt a worm. And they don't care about butenone, but they can smell it. Or taste it, however you want to say it. And they don't have eyes, but they can smell and taste really well. And if they sense that, and there's a lot of food, and then now you put them on a plate without food, and they get to choose between a neutral spot and something where butenone is, they make a beeline for the butenone. And they can remember that.
So they've associated that with the food.
Yeah, and the talk I was over at Baylor this week was talking about that particular test with aging. And how long-term memory works. And so worms are also famous for aging research. And in 1993, Cynthia Kenyon at UCSF published the first genetic mutant that lived longer. And it happened to be a reduced function mutation in the insulin receptor, and it's really related to food and metabolism. And so this has become a huge cottage industry in many different systems where people study this kind of stuff. But it's a big deal in worms because... when they only live half a week, you can do a lot of aging tests. So that's another big thing we do.
That's amazing that you can get so much from such a from a worm, something that people see and get squeamish.
Yeah, well, and I will say, you know, you've seen an earthworm. These things you can't even see. So, you know, somebody in the room probably has some on their shoes dried up. I tell you, if you've walked across some grass, there's a decent chance. And there's one little story. When I was a sophomore in college, I was taking a plants class. And we went out and grabbed moss, you know, just fuzzy little moss, and put it in a plate. And I looked at it under a scope, and there's this little guy waving at me. And it was a worm. And I'd taken a basic animals biology course before, and I said, I think that's a nematode. And little did I know, I was destined to spend my life researching. It may actually have been C. elegans or one of its close relatives. Yeah. I'm sure it was. Yeah. But it was... Had I known, there would have been a dun-dun-dun in the background, lightning striking, something like that.
They
would have
said,
this is your future, and you're going to look at tens of thousands of these things.
I know you and your lab had a featured article in the journal Genetics a little while ago. So could you tell me about that research and what you found?
Sure. So I have to give you a little background, but we'll keep it non-technical wherever possible. So first I have to say the word RAS, R-A-S. And the reason is RAS is the big one. It is by far the most mutated cancer driver. We call them oncogenes or cancer genes. Mm-hmm. And about a third of all human tumors have a RAS mutant that turns it on, locks it in the on state. This is bad. RAS is also a greasy ball, so you can't target it with drugs. So we've really struggled in 35 years, and we, again, I'm using the community, has struggled to how to figure out how to handle RAS. I should also add, particularly lethal cancers like certain types of pancreatic cancer are 95% RAS mutants. So they're essentially 100% RAS. And so we'd still really like to know how it does that. So we're studying, we actually study RAS-related molecules, proteins in the worm, genes, And one of them is called RAP1, and RAP stands for RAS proximal. We also study a gene called RAL, which stands for RAS-like. And so you get a lot of RA something. And the alphabet soup tends to drown people. So we'll keep it to RAP1. And so we were studying RAP1, and RAP1 is actually super similar to RAS. I'd call them siblings or first cousins or something like that. And they actually, the part of the protein that sticks to partners is identical. So it's long been a mystery in the cancer world why RAP1 is not mutated in cancer and what is its relationship to RAS. And for various technical reasons, there have been a lot of red herrings, misleading, you know, false leads. RAP1 has been very enigmatic. The nice thing is worms have a single RAS and a single RAP1. And if you look at humans, they have three RAS proteins and two RAP1s. And so, or mouse, or any other animal with a backbone has these multiple genes. And so from a geneticist point of view, that's a nightmare. In a worm, it's simple. So what we did is we used CRISPR. We locked RAP1 in the on state, like a cancerous RAS would look like. And it caused a weak but measurable RAS-like phenotype. So the postdoc in the lab who did this work, Neil Rasmussen, likes to refer to a movie for this. And the movie is, I don't know if you remember those old Austin Powers movies, the James Bond spoofs. And he says RAS is Dr. Evil, right? The evil scientist he's bald, he's got the gray suit. Mike Myers really hams this up. It's a great role. And he's going to take over the world and do evil things. I can't even remember what the plot was. It's a James Bond movie with humor. And so RAS is Dr. Evil, and RAP1 is Mini-Me. Okay, so, and this is a really good way of thinking about it, is it turns out that RAP1 is actually, we call it a shadow RAS, but really Mini-Me is a great way of putting it. And it's basic, what we think is it's actually reinforcing whatever RAS does in development. And so we got a smoking gun experiment by locking RAP1 in the on position and getting some RAS-like biological effects that came out of that. And so that's why this is a feature paper, because this has been a mystery for a long time.
About why one is cancerous and one isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast and telling us all about your work with genetics and cancer and explaining what CRISPR is.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you all so much for listening, and we will see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Texas A&M Health Talk, a production of the Texas A&M University Health Science Center. Visit us on the web at vitalrecord.tamhsc.edu, where you'll find answers to all of your health questions. Until next time, stay healthy.